Okay, it's time for our Wellness Wednesday feature. And today we're going to talk about heart failure in Ireland and living with the chronic disease. Joining us, Dr. Angie Brand, consultant cardiologist and medical director with the Irish Heart Foundation. Thanks, Angie, for joining us.
Good morning, Greg.
And we'll also speak momentarily to Pauline O'Shea, who's living with heart failure for over a decade now. Pauline, good morning to you.
Good morning.
All right, thanks for joining us. Dr. Angie, I might talk with you, if that's okay, first. When we talk about heart failure, I think people think heart failure might be a stroke or a heart attack, but obviously it's much broader than that. So give us a better understanding of what we mean when we talk of heart failure.
So really what heart failure means, and we try not to talk so much about failure because that's very scary for people, that heart insufficiency. So basically what it means is the heart pumping function isn't working as well. It can't pump blood around the body and provide oxygen to all the organs as efficiently as a normal heart would. So the heart has been damaged in some way, and it can be damaged by lots of different things. So if you have a long history of high blood pressure, if you've had problems with your arteries, blockage in the arteries and heart attacks or other lack of blood supply to the heart, diabetics have an increased risk. Infections can cause a myocarditis, causing inflammation in the heart. And then some congenital diseases, rhythm diseases, valve diseases, drugs and toxins can all cause problems with the heart. So lots of things can cause this problem with heart pumping function. And when you have impaired pumping function, what this causes for patients is that they get very breathless, they have profound fatigue, they find it very difficult to do normal day-to-day activities. They may have swelling in the ankles. They may not be able to lie flat at night and wake up breathless and need to sleep propped up with pillows. So lots of symptoms are associated with this lack of proper pumping of the heart.
And Dr. Brown, if we get everything right in terms of, you know, a speedy diagnosis, the correct care and the correct aftercare, what is the prognosis? How manageable is it? What kind of a life, if I say we got everything right, could a person expect to lead?
So there are obviously lots of different degrees of heart failure, from mild to severe. So it will depend a little bit on the underlying cause and how soon that you get it. For instance, if someone's having a heart attack and they get to hospital very quickly, you might reduce the amount of damage that is done, so someone could have a very good prognosis. But if someone has a congenital defect in one of the things that helps you pump one of the muscles in the heart, this is something that is a chronic disease that you have to live with. We do have lots of excellent medications now that will improve people's mortality and morbidity. So the medicines do certainly help people live longer and feel better, improve the quality of life. And we have devices that can go into the heart to try and prevent rhythm disturbances. But this is a chronic disease. It has high mortality rates. The mortality rates, if you're diagnosed with significant heart failure, around 36% over 5 years. Mm. So this is higher than lots of other cancers and things. So it really does have a high mortality rate. But we are getting much better in treating it and managing it. But it's a major thing for people to have to live with the effects of heart failure, as I'm sure we will hear from Pauline.
Yeah, for sure. And before I bring Pauline in, just a couple of other statistics then. In terms of age demographics, are there particular groups of people that are more likely to be diagnosed with heart failure or heart insufficiency, I think you might have called it?
Yeah. So, well, as I said, lots of different causes of heart failure. It becomes more common as you get older. But we know from some estimates from the HSC that actually there's over 32,000 people suffering from heart failure who are less than 65 years of age. Mm. So I think it's important to remember that it affects all age groups. And actually, it's very common. We estimate it affects about 2% of the Irish population. That's nearly 100,000 people are living with heart failure in Ireland. There's about 10,000 new cases every year. So it's actually very common, and the prevalence is increasing, so the numbers are increasing. So we really do need a national registry so we have a better and more accurate idea of how many people are suffering from heart failure so we can plan services properly and provide for these patients.
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable that that's absent, because how could you know the full extent of a problem or plan for it if you don't actually have a proper audit of the amount of people that it affects?
Absolutely, yeah. And the impact is so profound, as we'll hear from.
Yeah, well, let's do that right now, Doctor. Thank you very much for that. Stay where you are. Pauline O'Shea, you've lived now with this condition for 11 years. And I suppose to some extent, I don't know how, you know, outwardly, people would not know that you are living with this chronic condition, Pauline.
Yes, indeed. So, yes, I am 11 years, and I would say to anybody listening to the radio this morning who has a diagnosis of heart failure, the term itself is terrifying. Mm. So I would just say, first of all, we'd love a rebranding of that. But that aside, years are possible too. I know we talk about a third of people sort of within a five-year period is mortality rate. But at the end of the day, there are more people surviving. Therapies have got better and medications have got better. And I suppose I'm an example of that. I'm 11 years on. And so I'd like to give anybody listening a little bit of hope on that front.
And when, and I think that's really valuable, Pauline. So do you mind me asking what age you were when you were diagnosed, and what led to that diagnosis? How was your health impacted,
sure,
if that's okay?
Yep. So I was 38, and my situation really was I had just had my third baby, and I had an issue called SCAD. It was where an artery in my heart tore. But unfortunately, I was misdiagnosed as having a virus. Mm. So I was sent home, and, you know, I suppose I was readmitted. And again, nobody could spot SCAD because you need to have a particular you know, cardiac test, an angiogram to see it, and that wasn't conducted. So as a result, I ended up having three heart attacks, and I ended up going into cardiac arrest. The problem was that all those heart attacks and a cardiac arrest deprived my heart of oxygen. So while the artery was eventually repaired through a bypass, the oxygen deprivation had left, as I was told, part of my heart dead. And that was really, really terrifying because, as I say, I just had my third baby. I was 38. It was a time of life and newness. And this diagnosis, I had no concept other than the term suggested to me that my heart was failing, rather than in, you know, as the term is kind of meant to describe, it's just not functioning as well. And so it was absolutely horrendous. And I have to say, while I could understand medically what they were telling me, it was the implications for the rest of my life that were the devastation. Because I thought, how am I going to be a mother? How am I going to function? Am I going to function? You know, and what do I expect? I didn't know at that time. I was told in a hospital bed, and I
Okay, we seem to have lost that. No,
will
you're back there now.
Sorry,
I beg your pardon, Pauline. The line dropped out. So you were told in a hospital bed. Just pick it up from there, please, if you don't mind.
Oh, sorry. Told in the hospital bed, and I said I looked across the ward and I saw the bathrooms, and I remember thinking, you know, could me going from this bed over to there be the end? Mm-hmm. You know, I really had no idea what to expect. So I understood medically what had happened, but I just could not grasp what it meant for my life. And the years after that, that was the biggest struggle for me, trying to adapt this condition and understand how I was going to live a life and be a mother and do all those normal things for my stage of life.
Yeah, well, there's a lot for you to work through there, that stuff that you kind of have control over. But in terms of supports, you know, be it financial support, you mentioned, you know, obviously you went from a two-income family to one. You faced all the bills and what have you, but also on top of that, medical costs. And was there enough support, or do you get enough support through your recovery and beginning you know, the next, a very different kind of life, I suppose, to some extent. What is the follow-up like in terms of, you know, the next five, the next 10 years?
Okay, well, I will honestly say, unfortunately, there were no supports. And, you know, this is part of the problem, because when you walk out the hospital doors, that's the first day of the rest of your life, really. And there was no supports. So economically, I had been running my own business. I was not able to continue with that. So, yes, we went from a two-income household to one income. On top of that, we had my husband was trying to come home to relieve me, because my energy, as a result of heart failure and everything I'd been through, I was very, very energy deprived. So our income dropped drastically. And at that time, unfortunately, if you were self-employed, you weren't entitled to anything. You weren't entitled to medical cards. You weren't entitled to anything. So there were no supports. I survived financially because somehow I had the presence of mind 10 years earlier to take out an income protection policy.
Well,
that is what helped us sustain ourselves. But not everybody will have done that. But it was an absolute nightmare financially. Mm. It was psychologically, I couldn't move from A to B in my own home without wondering if this would set off you know, I had a defibrillator installed. So it was a question of how much can I do in any given day? Will walking over to put on the kettle, will doing anything cause this?
How long, Pauline, did it take?
How
long did it take to sort of work through that and to be able to trust what you could and couldn't do? Or maybe it's ever present. Oh. But how long did it take to whereby you said, well, you know what? I can't answer if walking to the bathroom is going to kill me, but I have to walk to the bathroom. Do you know, did you have to work through it that way?
Yeah, it's the suck it and see type approach. That's what I had to do. And that was, you had to have, you know, a degree of bravery with every attempt. So, yes, I also went to lots of counselling, which, you know, again, that's very expensive. So it was really trying to figure out how to be able to afford that. I met a lovely lady who sort of helped, you know, said to me that I could pay when I could afford it. But not everybody has that, you know, opportunity either. So it was a mixture of professional help and just trying to put one foot in front of the other and take, I suppose, chances in the hope that I was going to be okay. Mm. But can I just say that the Irish Heart Foundation now, and this is for any, again, of the patients that might be listening today, they offer 6 free counselling sessions. Mm. So for anybody who is in this boat now, there is counselling available to you. There is information on economic supports available to you all through the Irish Heart Foundation. And it's really fantastic to see how that has come on, because I wish I had had that back in the day when it was my beginning, you know.
And I suppose you're coming back to a house with children in it and a partner, and to some extent you're counselling them whilst you're probably needing counselling yourself, trying to make sure everyone feels that everything's going to be okay. I wonder, Pauline, if you don't mind me asking, and maybe it's individual, you know, I speak to people through features like this who've suffered a heart attack or particularly stroke, and it can have, you know, emotional impacts on them in terms of depression or you know, is that the same with heart failure? Do you have to deal with that too?
Well, 100%. I mean, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and I didn't even know what that meant. I thought it was that I was, you know, would be reliving the experience. But really what it was that when you've been through something very traumatic and it's a life or death situation, your brain is always going to be functioning at a level of trying to appraise everything from there on in that scale of life or death. And it means really in day-to-day life that your anxiety levels are very high.
Yeah.
And when somebody is suggesting anything, the overwhelm hits very quickly. And that is very difficult in family life. My 3 kids, apart from the physicality of trying to manage being a mom, and I needed so much help from my own parents, and they were amazing to me. But, you know, the emotional side was difficult. As you say, there was a kind of a trying to present the best image to them so that they weren't frightened. Yeah. But, you know, really inside, feeling absolutely terrified. And now they're a bit older and I can talk to them about when mom gets, you know, kind of anxious. Because nowadays my teenagers would say, chill out, mom. But I would say, hang on now. You know, I know that might seem like an overreaction to you, but remember, my brain is always going to have the residual firefighter.
It's always going to try and protect you. It's going to say, the brain almost wants to survive itself, and it's saying, hold on, you Pauline, you can't do that because this might happen, and you have to sort of process that and say, listen, brain, I know what I'm doing. Do you know what I mean?
That's right, and that's why we need professional help in many respects, because I would never have understood that was what my brain was doing in future anxious moments. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it took somebody explaining that to me, which has been hugely beneficial. And that's why our patients, I mean, remember, you're living with something that sounds like you're going to die, right, pretty quickly. That's the first thing, the problem with the term. And then the implications in your life, and particularly if you have a defibrillator installed in your body, that raises alarm bells for your brain, you know?
Exactly. And it's saying, hold on, I want you lying down in bed, not doing anything, because then I'll survive. That's what the brain is telling you. And also, too, because of the type of condition, it's like they say the anticipation of something is worse than the event itself, but you're constantly, every second, you could potentially be saying, is the next second the day that, you know, defib kicks in? Stay there, Pauline, because I know both of you are very busy. I just want to go back to Dr. Angie Brown for a second. In terms of people can get this problem with their heart for many different reasons. I presume much or some of it, Angie, is preventable. Is it the usual lifestyle advice, dietary advice, exercise that we can best try? As I say, some people, it can be hereditary or for other reasons, but to best try and prevent heart failure.
Exactly, you're absolutely right. Some of the causes of heart failure are preventable. So, for instance, high blood pressure, which is a very common condition, and the only way you know you have high blood pressure is to get your blood pressure checked. So it's very important that everyone gets a blood pressure checked, and if you have high blood pressure, that it's treated and you keep managing it, because it can go higher or lower as you get older. So keep getting it checked and make sure that the blood pressure is well controlled. So that's one risk factor that is easy to treat. Obviously, things like gaining weight, having sleep apnea, these are all things that are harder to treat, but by having a healthy diet and healthy lifestyle, that's going to improve those risk factors. And coronary disease is another cause of having heart problems. So again, the healthy diet, the exercise, stopping smoking, and trying to get your cholesterol checked and keep an eye on your blood, all of those things will reduce your risk of developing heart failure in the future. So that is the good news. And I think the other thing to say, just to mirror what Pauline says, is that we have got so many new medications available now since Pauline was diagnosed. So the treatment for heart failure is improving an awful lot. So people's quality of life is better. And we have things like defibrillators and special sorts of pacemakers, which can also improve people's quality of life and reduce their risk as well, which is also good news. But as Pauline says, I think it's very important for people to have these community supports as well, because of the huge psychological impact. So we are calling for the government to support increased services in psychology to help these patients. And the Heart Foundation, we've got Heart Connect programs, as Pauline mentioned, in the community. And these can help people manage their heart failure and give peer-to-peer support, phone support and all that. So an awful lot is being done and more needs to be done.
Yeah, OK. Dr. Angie Brown, thank you very much indeed. Finally, Pauline, you mentioned it being called heart failure. You know, if you do happen to have a conversation with someone, what phrase do you use? Because I presume you don't want to keep going through that, yes, it's heart failure, but look, here I am, living proof that, you know, I'm still here, if you know what I mean. It's kind of like you have to make an argument against the name of the condition that you have.
Yes. So I take it completely out of a medical kind of setting, and I call it pumps and pipes, right? So okay. Basically, My pipe work had a tear, and that was for a genetic reason, and that was fixed. But the fact that I waited so long for that to be fixed meant that the pump itself got damaged. And that's really the difference.
Do you have a frustration perhaps the situation is worse because you were misdiagnosed, or do you not allow yourself to get too frustrated about that?
At the end of the day, look, we have to, again, this is the mindset and the counselling where it comes in.
Yeah.
You can choose to go over and rehash, but to be honest, it's not going to do you any good physically or mentally.
Yes.
So what I've had to do is take my particular struggle and see how can I do as much good with this as possible. And that's why I do talks like this or interviews or whatever I'm asked to do, because if it's possible that my story can help somebody else, then I can kind of live with it better that the stuff that the misdiagnosis happened, you know. It's good. It's healing for me to be able to help somebody else who might be newly diagnosed or not diagnosed for a while, but feeling stuck in the limitation of that diagnosis. So the more work we can do to help and support other heart failure patients, and indeed for other heart conditions too, the better. And it's a privilege to be able to be here today and to be able to speak. And I hope it'll give a little bit of hope to some of the people that might be listening, or maybe family members too, who equally worry so much about somebody in their family diagnosed.
Yeah, well, that message is exactly, and that message from you, because you've said it intermittently throughout the conversation, has come through loud and clear, and you're living proof of that. And I'm delighted to be able to speak to you. Best wishes to you and for your future, and to your family as well, because they all kind of have your condition too, I'm sure, as well. If you get where I'm coming from in terms of being with you and supporting you and loving you, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye bye.
Appreciate it.
No, it's our pleasure to have you on. Bye bye. Thank you to Pauline O'Shea, Dr. Angie Brown, and we'll be back with more in the 9 till noon show, including the 100. Oh, by the way, just a little bit of emerging news. It's back to this other conversation, and I'm really conscious you could be getting sick of it, but we can't ignore the biggest story in the country, can you? Ryan Tubridy's out of contract at RTE. Apparently, they were in negotiations about a new radio contract, this after him leaving the Late Late Show. Those talks are now paused. So effectively, I don't know what that actually means, effectively, but RTE has written to Ryan Tubridy's agent that the contract, including all arrangements therein, has come to an end. Negotiations, as I said, had commenced regarding his radio responsibilities. Those negotiations have been paused, with all negotiations as per the board statement. Right, so that means he might not get his extra 75k on top of his salary for the next 2 years. That's an emerging story. All right, back with more shortly.
Business Matters, in association with the ATU Donegal Faculty of Business. If you have an undergrad in any discipline and would like to reinforce it with a Master's in Business, ATU are offering their Master's in Business Management Conversion Programme. Call 9186206 or email donald.hannigan@atu.ie.
Right, stay with us, particularly if you message or text the show. That we have dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, which we will work through. Some of them, of course, as much as we can before the end of the programme. I'd be very conscious that sometimes people might text something in, and because it's not read straight away, they might think, oh, he's not reading that, or I pretty much... There's even messages that Caroline scribbles out, and I have to read the message through the scribble. So they're not, unless there's something libelous in it, they're not edited, and hopefully I'll get to yours before the end of this programme. But I've got a really interesting guest, some would say. I'm not saying I'd say it. An interesting guest in on the programme now. It is, of course, our own Kieran O'Donnell. Hi, Kieran.
Good morning, Greg.
Presenter of the Business Matters podcast, which is live right now on our website, because I saw it scheduled last evening. You can check it out in the playback section. It's going to be in the featured story section for the next couple of hours, and you can listen to it at your leisure. It's also on Spotify and iTunes. Okay, so before we get into the nuts and bolts of what's coming up on the pod, let's talk about a little bit of news. The the Donegal Enterprise office has a bit of a boot camp coming up. It's not the first.
Yeah, such was the success, Greg, of Donegal Local Enterprise Office's first Start Your Own Business one-day boot camp that it has organised a second for Saturday, July the 15th at the Clannery Hotel in Letterkenny, and that is taking place between 9:30am and 5pm. So whatever stage of the Start Your Own Business journey people are on, this one-day boot camp will empower them to develop their ideas and help them devise a plan to get their new business up and running. To register and find out more, Greg, check out Donegal Local Enterprise Office social media platforms.
Rightio. Congratulations to the Rusty Mackerel.
Yeah, the Rusty Mackerel in Tiedin has won the Pub of the Year 2023 at the Irish Hospitality Awards. This is the latest award for the renowned traditional Irish bar and restaurant, which also has 13 five-star bedrooms.
Well done, everyone out there. Staying in hospitality, the Mount Errigal, they have an open day.
Yeah, hospitality is the theme this week, Greg. I'm just thinking they're going through it. The Mount Errigal Hotel in Letterkenny recruited 10 new staff members during its recent open day, bringing its total number of employees to around 130. This is a new and different approach to recruiting staff, and the general manager of the hotel, Conor McAnuff, told me that it's something that they'll definitely look at again, maybe at the end of the year, Greg. So it's a new way of doing things and a better way, according to Conor.
Yeah, I suppose you get to see people straight away. Well, people are walking in. Yeah,
they're getting the feel for the
CVs,
place, and employers getting the feel for the employee, you know, so it works both ways.
It's good for the employee too, because I think people can struggle a little bit to sort of hit the right note with the CV.
Yeah.
But if you're there and able to present yourself, no, I might be misreading it, but I that's one advantage I can see from it.
Yeah, and obviously it's an interpersonal industry, and look, it's... As a new thing, as a thing that I think they will do more of.
All right, okay, the Water's Edge has changed hands.
Yeah, a seal agreed sign has been placed outside the Water's Edge restaurant in Rathmullen. Comprising a bar, lounge, restaurant and 10 bedrooms, it is a floor area of just under 10,000 square feet. Daft.ie is handling the seal, and the selling price has not been disclosed, and the owner has, or the potential buyer has not been disclosed either.
Well, hopefully the new buyer got a good price, had great success, and hopefully those exiting feel that they've got their just rewards. All right, and now down to Harvey's Point on the shores of Loch Esk.
Yes, Harvey's Point has become the first hospitality venue in Donegal to receive the 50 Shades Greener Gold Level Award for Sustainable Excellence. The award-winning Donegal Town Hotel was supported on its journey through Donegal ETB's Further Education and Training Services. So, Greg, for businesses who'd like to find out how this programme could support their business to develop a more sustainable future, they can contact Enterprise Engagement at donegaletb.ie.
Right, okay. Now, as you said yourself, continuing that sort of hospitality theme, the guest on this week's pod is...
Yes, Greg, this week I'm joined by the co-owner of Cashton Ore Hotel and the co-owner of Errigal Brewing in Annagry, James McDevitt. Cashton Ore, which employs around 60 people, was opened in 2002, and last year James and his sister Anita secured a licence for their brewery. A qualified secondary school teacher, James has a huge passion for the hospitality sector and a massive gra for the Annagry area. In this clip, James talks about the setting up of Cashton Ore 21 years ago.
Right, well, you see, there's a slight problem. I don't have the clip. Caroline, could you see if production could put through James, the clip of James? I don't seem to have it here. It's just not... I should have checked beforehand, but it's always there. But not paraphrase it, just in case we get it through quite promptly. Right, 21 years.
Yeah, look, James, the family business, the business has been in the family for quite a while. His mother and father owned what was a pub there in 1978, Greg. They built the hotel in 2002. It has 16 bedrooms initially, and then they
added... Right, we have a technical fault, so you're going to have to give us a preview.
They added three more bedrooms onto it. I think it was in 2016, and they also added a ballroom, which has a capacity for 200 guests at a wedding, and I was down at a wedding there recently. So he has a huge grasp for the area. It was a chance conversation and a chance meeting over the last couple of years with a few different people that led to them acquiring a brewery. They've got the license, they've built the brewery at the back of the hotel. And
I always thought that brewery thing sort of, I honestly, you know, when it sort of started coming into the fore a few years ago,
yes.
I thought it was a fad. I didn't realise that it is, you know, that that there is there's a huge tourism industry to it and all that kind of stuff. And it's certainly not a fad because there's lots of these established for quite some time and are really successful.
Yeah, the one thing James actually noted, I suppose, Annagry, I mean, it has both a distillery and a brewery. Yeah. And for a rural area like that, he's a big believer that tourism, you know, as an industry that needs maybe more support as a big part of life down there. He talked too about the unique welcome that the Gaeltacht area is able to afford people who come there. And we had a very good conversation. I suppose the fact that they acquired the brewery, it was something that the family had looked at developing a number of years ago. It didn't work out. And then through a number of just chance conversations and meetings, he's ended up setting up the brew down there beside him.
Okay, and we'll just before we get into that, you talked to this. Excuse me. I'm not saying Donegal is unique, but it feels unique. It is like until relatively recent, I didn't really travel through Donegal as much as I could. I did lots of places, but it was like from where I am to somewhere. Do you know what I mean? And it's only more recently, and maybe it's through lockdown, but it came before that, though, that we've got different parts of Donegal that are like going into a different place. It's just a different feel to it. And be it the locals or the shops or the bars or whatever it might be, you know, there is so much to explore, be it, you know, through Inishowen and not just the beaten track of Inishowen, other parts of it, through the Gaeltacht, as you mentioned, up Fanard way, up Downing's, Carrigart way, different experience, out towards Killybegs, Kilcar. Do you know what I mean? There's different, it just is a different feeling, different sense, all within this one county of our own, Kieran.
Yeah, Greg, look, I've spoken to
the islands. I didn't mention the islands.
I've spoken to dozens of people in the hospitality and tourism sector over the last few years doing the show. I think COVID was a major turning point in what you're saying there, and it afforded people, first of all, the opportunity to go and maybe explore what was around them, and they didn't have to go too far away to get that. And that's exactly what you're talking about. Donegal has a lot to offer, and I still think, you know, COVID has been a major factor in the likes of Annagry. I was over with Kieran McHugh, who's on next week. He's over in the campsite over there, and they won an award there as well, and he's saying the same thing. COVID is actually prompting people to come, and they mightn't have to come in too far away to come and enjoy his service.
Indeed, and there was a period I had a caravan, and it pretty much was only just going around Donegal, but it was just like, you know, even though it was your own county and you know people when you're there, it just felt different, felt like a holiday. Right, okay, we're going to hear now that clip from James McDevitt. Now we've resolved that technical issue. Here he is. This is just part of his conversation with Kieran.
Caislanor Hotel was set up and built in the year 2002. It was developed by my father, my brother Joe, who's deceased, and my sister Anita, and myself. My mother was also the strong force behind us all. She kept us all in line. And I suppose we had the foundations of the family business. There was a pub and a restaurant and a function room on the site where the hotel is now. And we were very fortunate to have a great thriving business. And Dom, my father, had a vision that Annagry needed a hotel, and he also believed that there was opportunities for us all to get good jobs and be fit to stay at home and not have to face the emigration that all of his generation faced.
All right, much more from James in the full podcast. The full interview available with James McDevitt to download now at highlandradio.com, or you can stream it wherever you get your podcasts to, providing it's Spotify or iTunes. And if people want to listen to it on the radio, of course, Kieran.
Yeah, after the 6 o'clock news, Greg, on Sunday evening.
And if anyone wants to get in contact with you, how do they do so?
Drop me an email, please. businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
Kieran O'Donnell, thank you so much for your time, Greg. As always. We really do appreciate your efforts in getting some of that news together for us and what have you. Thanks, Kieran. Right, let's get to a few more of your comments. A lot of support for Dr. Joe Kelly. Very well said, Joe Kelly, from Sean in Falkara. Another hope the historian hasn't forgotten the famous politics of the 80s, the politicians who told us all to tighten our belts. Okay. With reference to the RTE scandal and Ryan Tuberty, he's been very quiet in what he's been saying. He must have known he was getting this money. But it's typical. Big organisations, they put somebody under the bus to take all the blame and move on. It's nothing as if nothing has happened. I bet you're still getting her full pension and her full payment. As for Tuberty, you should pay back all the extra money and it should be off the radio for good. I'll never listen to him again. Well, listen, I mean, at the end of the day, though, his agent on his behalf brokered the best deal he could for him. Now, we might not like how much it is. I don't know. Some people don't mind. We might not like how his agent and RTE negotiated the deal. But his agent was acting on behalf of Tuberty. And I think he's saying what he should have said is that I'm getting paid more than has been publicly declared. But if someone walked in here and I don't know what I'd do, actually. I can't say that with any honesty or truth. Hi, Greg. RTE have always seemed to have antipathy or at least little interest in Donegal. Very late to take an interest in the defective concrete scandal, for instance. I don't know why, really, as the late Gay Byrne always flew the flag for Donegal. Could you get an interview with Donegal woman Moya Doherty or Donegal man Joe Mulholland? Both had top positions in RTE. Well, we have tried. No joy. Other Donegal employees of RTE as well. But listen, there's one thing I think for an RTE employee, and I'd support them in what they're doing, to go out and picket or protest outside their own radio stations or TV stations because they're peed off, let's put it like that. I think it'd be a different thing, and I wouldn't expect them to go on to an independent station or a rival, in inverted commas, and badmouth their employer. I wouldn't expect them to. I wouldn't judge them in that. And we would ask just to see if they'd want to, but I fully understand. I wouldn't expect it, nor would I judge them for not doing so, because it's different, because it brings it outside their internal squabbles. RTE, no accountability. Judges, no accountability. HSC, no accountability. Planning, no accountability. Micah, no accountability. Abuse scandals, Children's Hospital, no accountability. False allegations, no accountability. The list goes on and on forever, and we will get, all we get back is waffle with little or no accountability or consequences. Common denominator, the current government and the permanent civil servant, says that listener. Love it when you have Joe on. He talks a lot of sense and he's inherited that from his late dad. He teaches my grandchildren and they love him as a teacher. A lot of the young Irish voters are emigrating, and that will suit those parties that have been in power since the beginning of this state. So change is hard to bring about. Yes, I see the connection you're making there. Like Dr. Joe, this country is crying out for moral leadership. Look at George Lee. He didn't last long in his attempt to try and change the political system. He said after leaving, anyone who thinks they're going to change what's going on in the Dáil, they are in dreamland. Okay, thank you for that. A few more before the break and before we bring in our next guest. Hi, Greg. Would agree with Joe. It's coming to a stage in Ireland. You'd need free wages going into the bank every week to pay the bills. Ireland has become a joke to live in. Another, a lot of years ago, Charles Haughey stood on RTE News and told us that we need to tighten up our belts. He was living like a king. Everyone else had nothing. What has changed over 40 years later? Not much. Why would government want to have access to whatever activities you're doing on your phone? I don't know. I mentioned that, actually, and I just wanted to bring you, as I say, in another society or in another in another maybe news day, this would be big news. But just to let you know what happened yesterday, Justice Minister Helen McEntee has obtained a High Court order requiring telecom providers, that's your mobile phone providers, to retain certain data due to a genuine and serious threat to the state. The order will compel companies to retain user location and traffic data from mobile phones and other devices for the next year for the purpose of the safeguarding the security of the state. This was made possible due to an amendment of the Communications Act 2022, which came into operation yesterday. The amendment only allows for the general and indiscriminate retention of data when it is to safeguard the security of the state and only when a High Court judge grants motion to do so. This can only be sought where the Minister for Justice is satisfied that there exists a serious and genuine present or foreseeable threat to the security of the state. So, I mean, this is really quite a bold move to retain all of our mobile phone and tablet data for a year. What is this threat to the security of the state? Why is no one asking that? I don't know. I'm flabbergasted by it all. Rightio, an EPA report on domestic waste water treatment systems, i.e. your septic tank, has found that half of them in Ireland failed inspections last year, 20% of those posing a risk to human health and the environment. 44% of septic tanks in Donegal failed the inspection last year. Jim Moriarty, Senior Manager in the Office of Environment Enforcement. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, OK. So what do we take from this? Like, how many, do we know how many septic tanks in total were inspected? And that, what happens if they failed the inspection?
Yeah, the EPA report today reports on over 1,100 inspections carried out by local authorities throughout the country. And at half of them failed is the finding in the report. This is consistent with prior years. We produce a report every year, and unfortunately the failure rate is that. But what's important really is that where failures are identified, the homeowners are issued with an advisory, a notice what to do, and then they need to follow through and ensure that the necessary works are done to fix the problems that have been identified.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's not always obvious to the owner of the septic tank that it would fail an inspection, so it might come as a shock to quite a number of people. What kind of things are they failing on?
Yeah, that's certainly true, Greg. Often septic tanks are down at the corner of a garden, so they're maybe out of sight, out of mind, but sometimes they may have an idea from a backup in the system or smells coming through the pipes or ponding evident in the garden. So people should do simple checks themselves. But the types of things that are being failed for the most common are not desludging the tank often enough, perhaps ponding around the tank, which would be an indication that there's a leak in the tank. These are things that are being found. And as I say, local authorities issue advisory and notices to people to carry out works to fix them. And about 80% of those works are done. So that's good. But there's, 20% of them that aren't done. And in particular, some of them are a couple of years old now. It may take time to arrange to get works done. So in cases where they're open for more than 2 years, we're really calling on the local authorities involved to follow through with the householders, avail of the grants, but ensure that the risks to public health are going to be dealt with.
Is there, and we'll talk about what those risks are, is there an argument for better information to be out there for the public, i.e., does everybody know how often the tank needs to be emptied? It varies, of course, depending on its use, but what are the indicators, other than it overflowing or ponding, what are the indicators that it needs to be changed? It's a simple thing, but at the same time, it might be complex for some. I would love to just see the public empowered with information so that, we can weed out those that just don't give a damn from those that just don't really know.
That's a good point, Greg. And part of the National Inspection Plan, which the EPA draws up every year, is an engagement piece. So there are information sheets. Local authorities have them. The EPA website has information on things like how often to desludge your tank, depending on how many people are in the household. The answer to that is somewhere between 2 and 3 years for a typical household of 4 or 5 people. You need to desludge the tank, which costs €250. Every 2 to 3 years. But there is good information there. And before an inspection is carried out, homeowners are given 10 days a notice, and local authorities send out information sheets to them on these types of things before the inspections are carried out. So more can be done, of course, to increase kind of awareness, but every chance that's there is being taken to try and address that.
Yeah, what are the potential environmental impacts?
Yeah, there's two impacts from faulty septic tanks in the main. One is a risk to public health, and by that I mean very often septic tanks are co-located with households where there's a household well. So if there's a leaky or a faulty septic tank, then a household's drinking water could become infected with sewage and cause issues from a human health point of view. So that's a risk, clearly. And then also, you can get leaks from the tank, which can contaminate groundwater, get into streams and waterways, and that can lead to fish kills, possibly, or can lead to damaged water quality. So human health is impacted, and the environment is potentially impacted as well.
All right, Jim, thanks for your time. Jim Moriarty, Senior Manager in the Office of Environment Enforcement. A caller says, RGAA matches in Croke Park next weekend shown on ordinary TV, or does it have to be paid for under the scheme? Thanks. Well, I can tell you that Saturday's games, there's four cracking games. Saturday's games are only on GEA Go. So you either are a subscriber or you'll have to pay for the games to watch them. Sunday, they're on terrestrial. So that's I can't think off the top of my head which games are on which day. But anyway, I have an irregular heartbeat and high blood pressure and sleep apnea, which there is a 2-year waiting list to be treated, which also affects my heart. My last checkup was a year and a half ago, and I'm meant to get a checkup every 6 months. I was told my irregular heartbeat was part of my heart, was going way too fast. And I was lucky I hadn't had a stroke before it was treated. It's too long to be waiting with that hanging over you, I'm sure. Greg, 40% of people in Ireland vote for the parties that condone the greed and corruption, and they think cheating the system and the people is okay. Joe's talking the truth, but 40% don't vote at all. And they're not represented in the democratic vote, but they're not engaging it either. Hi, Greg. Northern plates, you can't tell the age of the car, as every time a new reg comes out, you can re-register your car. Example, you can have a 1993 car on 2023 plates. Okay, listen, I was just told that once, but you're perfectly correct. You can do that here. We were asking, should we get away with putting the age of a car on the number plate? And let me see. How would you feel if the year was on your shoes? Remove the year from cars 100%. Yeah, I don't like it, but I don't know if... Why don't you like it? I don't know. Why should it be there? I think it's disgusting. We have to pay to watch for Gaelic football matches now and hurling. Some people don't have the money to pay for these channels. It's so therefore we can't support our counties. It's a disgrace, not to mention that even those that can afford it probably don't have the internet required. Hi, Greg. I love what you do for us, and I ask you to keep on keeping on. We need you. Before I'm written off as a far-right religious tin hat, may I give you the answer you're looking for? As today's troubles, the answers you seek are in the last pages of a book. It's a bit dusty, and if only for curiosity's sake, dust it off and read the last pages called The Revelations or Revelation. It tells us word for word what's happening now and what happens next. With all my love, Dee. Listen, Dee, thank you very much for that. For some people, that is the answer. That's the solution. That's the guidance. For others, it just simply is not. But people can agree with you, but they're just not taking the guidance from that dusty book you talk of. But I appreciate your text. And why would you be a far-right religious tin hat person just because that's your belief system? You certainly wouldn't be labelled as such on this programme. But I understand the caveat, but you don't need to do it, okay? It's just your opinion, that's fine. Greg, why is there no discussion about Micheál Martin's failure to get support for getting Ireland into NATO? He says he wasn't looking to get into NATO. There's never been a plan to get into NATO. Senior civil servants getting pay rises and us retained firefighters on the equivalent of less than €2 an hour when it's worked out. And they won't budge on a pay rise or restructuring of the service. That's long past being fit for purpose. Well, if they don't, we're not going to have a retained firefighter service because people aren't going to stick it. So if they want it, they're going to have to come to the table and negotiate. Because I've been speaking to a number of retained firefighters. Some of them not really terribly happy with the way their situation is being messaged by unions. They don't think the public are really getting a full grasp of what the problem is and what they want. I'm more than happy to give an actual retained firefighter a chance to explain that on the show, of course. That goes without saying. I agree 100% with Dr. Joe Kelly, as people are so busy they cannot see what is happening. Hi, Greg. I'd request the timing of the Late Late Show host's fall from grace. It all seems staged to me, and RTE needs to be investigated from the top down. And all of their associations with government need to be picked over with a fine-toothed comb. It is the independent contractors, film and video production companies that are going to suffer through no fault of their own from RTE's disregard for the public's money, though they are happy to spend it willy-nilly, they say. Government at fault for Ukraine and epidemic, a little beyond pessimistic. Has he any suggestions or is it all negativity? I did sort of suggest that I thought the argument would be better made if it was a little bit more nuanced. So I think maybe me and you might be in the same ballpark here. They go on to say, though, that faith and optimism are lost on this fella. Politics and religion are best kept apart. He sounds like he's out of tune with Ireland now and stuck in the past. Or maybe he says there's lessons from the past that can guide our future. Good morning, Greg. I've just been listening to that guy talking about ME, and it was like talking about myself. I was diagnosed with ME, chronic fatigue, and was running around in circles for years with declining health. I was diagnosed with Lyme disease in 2019 and I'm on the road to recovery. If you want to give that guy my number, I'd be more than happy to talk to him. Thanks. That comes in from Anne. And it's funny. It sounded like Lyme's to me. I'm not medical advice, no, nothing. I would just like if Des maybe double checked that he doesn't have Lyme. Dr. Lambert down in Dublin, it'd be very interesting for him to have a conversation with him just in case. Just in case. TV licence inspector in our estate in Ettrick, Kenny, today's got some cheek with everything going on. Come here, sympathies with him or her. I mean, of all the days, can you imagine? Right, come here. We're back tomorrow morning at 9. Have a lovely Wednesday. See you Thursday.